So we've talked about the change of priorities in complex trauma. You go from being a loving person, you get triggered, and you're a narcissist. So another way to look at this is when you're healthy, love is your priority. You're willing to sacrifice, you're willing to even put yourself in danger to meet the needs of others, to be there for others. Complex trauma, it says you have to protect self. So safety and survival are the priority. So what is happening in complex trauma is it's taking God-given priorities of love and it's trumping them. It's trumping them with safety. So what happens now is they say, I still want a loving relationship as long as I don't get hurt. So I will try to have a relationship, but the higher priority is not getting hurt. So I won't be totally real. I won't totally confront people or be honest because I can't get hurt. It doesn't work. Soon as you trump love with safety, it distorts love. And love goes in the wrong direction. But that is what happens. So shame we've talked about. So one way to look at it, shame is the root, the deepest wound of complex trauma. Shame, I think, and I get asked this all the time, I don't know that you ever totally get over it. You will be dealing with it for the rest of your life. It will get better and better. You'll accept yourself more. And so shame is huge. So a couple things I want to say to that. We tend to think that the answer to shame is learning to love yourself. I don't walk around saying, oh, I feel all warm, fuzzy about myself. That just, I don't get my head around that. The opposite of shame is accepting yourself, the way God made you, accepting your basic personality. So 75% of addicts were shy children. Guess how they view shyness? As bad. They wish they were the extrovert, the outgoing. They think that's healthy. And I go, I am a shy, analytical person. I hated that when I was growing up. And then I saw God made me into a great counselor because you need shy and analytical people. And so those things that I saw as weakness were actually God-given, and I had to accept those parts of me.
Isn't shame the answer for that, forgiveness for?
Okay, there's a part of that. Okay, so before I say that, another thing that gets confused around shame is sometimes you grew up saying you should be ashamed of yourself. That is not shame. That is a distortion. So that's a totally different thing. So it's saying if you respected yourself, you would behave better. Because you don't behave better, you should be ashamed. Okay? Shame is the core belief of what I believe about myself. So shame basically means I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm less than, something's wrong with me that makes me not as good as others. So that, everything then gets operated on. So when they go into a relationship, with shame you go, I gotta wear masks. Because if they see the real me, they'll reject me. So shame drives that. Shame makes them people pleasers, perfectionists, because they think if I do everything perfectly, then I'll like myself. And everybody else will like me. So shame is this deep, deep root. Okay, with shame, where it gets confused and comes to your thing, is guilt, okay? Shame is about who I am, my identity. So I'm a human being. Guilt is about what I do, okay? I'm a human doer. So guilt is about doing something that violates a moral standard. I lie, I cheat, I break a moral thing. Or in other words, guilt happens every time I violate love. So lying violates love, cheating violates love. All of those. So God has built this radar alarm system that says, beep, 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 you violated love, your conscience bothers you. And the goal of that was to bring you back into healthy, into this road. So that was the design. Okay, shame is about who I am. But what happens with shame is you did bad, so we think you are bad. So you're a human doer, that's bad. So you're a human being, that's bad. Okay, so what happens then is, so most addicts do not know how to be, they just know how to do. So they are human doers. They do not know how to be because they feel they have no value unless they're doing something. So unless they're pleasing you, accomplishing something, that's the only thing that gives them value. They have no intrinsic value. So that's the shame dilemma, the shame problem.
Is that self-worth?
Yes. Purity? Yes. Yeah. So where the answer becomes, so lots of shame is very low self-worth. So I think I'm garbage. I think I have no value. So the answer comes as they get older. The other piece is this. If you got lots of shame, every time you are unloving and now you have guilt, but guess what guilt will now feed? Shame. So guilt and shame now feed each other. Okay, so that's very important. So part of this accepting myself is I first have to forgive myself. So I did a lot of crap. There's no point beating myself up. It's not going to help anybody. I have to forgive. That is super difficult. So part of what we're going to see in these characteristics is what happens when a person failed is they got beat up verbally, emotionally, physically. So they learn to beat themselves up. So we say that people from complex trauma are very hard on themselves. And so if they fail, they beat themselves up for days because of all the guilt. Sometimes, yeah.
I've heard it said too that, you know, guilt is like I do bad.
Right.
Shame is I am bad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So identity versus actions.
Yeah. Someone says, you should be ashamed.
Exactly.
Like, did I feel shame? No freaking way.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I
so.
I have to stay alive, so I can't possibly go there.
Exactly. So what is very, very interesting, anybody brand new to recovery that comes in? You go, do you have low self-esteem or shame? No, I like myself. And what you realize is shame is so painful, they compensate. And they work hard to deny that they have shame and to try and compensate. So what is a psychopath? Super shame, but they are the most charming person in the world. They are overcompensating. And so shame is the toughest thing to face honestly, and it is super hard to deal with. And what makes it even more difficult is there's 1,000 things that will trigger shame. I ask clients all the time. Let's say you haven't visited with your parents for 5 years and you go home for Christmas. If mom raises her eyebrow a certain way, what do you feel? They go, shame. She didn't say a word. She just raised her eyebrow. If somebody cuts you off in a sentence or starts to turn away from you when you're talking, shame, shame. Somebody disagrees with you. Shame.
I just wanted to say it's a compliment to you where I feel like without grace, like some people can be right.
Yep.
And I'll give an example, right, for myself. I now can say, oh, I'm overly sensitive. Have been all my life. But sometimes I was already low self-esteem, shame, and whatnot. And people like, oh, you're just being sensitive.
Yes.
Like, get over
exactly.
It. Exactly. Right? And I would just shut down. That hit my shame
exactly.
So much. So
yeah.
I guess I'm just saying this out loud so I keep doing it because I think we have an opportunity when people like, I want to talk about my arrogance or my entitlement.
Exactly.
I've been selfish. I need some help. So instead of someone just like, yeah, I was watching. You need to be like, if we could just put the shame floors away and let people like
exactly.
name and
yes.
it's a compliment if
yes.
they're going, I'm sensitive or yeah. all these things that. Like, for example, that was the hardest thing for me. And I'm not alone. I think a lot of people will go into MMA fighting, will do, like, ridiculous stuff, do steroids.
Yep.
Just to overcompensate.
Oh, yeah.
Overcompensate.
Yep.
And deny
yep.
the reality.
Yep. So complex trauma homes typically are not grace homes. We had a girl stay with us just for a couple weeks, and my youngest daughter backed the car up and just put a little wee dent in the garage door, and the girl staying with us was just like, and she's studying my face and Kim's face. And then finally she said, aren't you going to get mad? It was an accident. But she was expecting this huge, you should be ashamed of yourself. Look what that's going to cost and blah, blah, blah. And so grace is a foreign concept. So they don't understand it. They're not familiar with it. And they don't trust it at first, but they long for it. And so if there's any legalism or judgmental, hyper-spiritual, like this, spiritual superiority, self-righteousness, that turns them right off. So let me give it to you this way. You should be ashamed of yourself. That's what we call humiliation. You are humiliated, and everybody from complex trauma has been humiliated, and they hate it. It's painful. You want to know what the solution to that is? Is humility. But humility feels like humiliation to them. And so for you to say, humble yourself before God and others, well, they'll humiliate me. I got to be tough. I got to be strong. I'd be on guard. And so for them to go to healing requires humility, but that is the scariest place in the world to come. So that's why I think Jesus said, it's like you got to be a seed that goes into the ground and kind of dies, because it feels like death to actually find humility, because you're pretty sure it's going to kill you. But then life comes out the other side. But that is a big thing. Okay, we're not going to even get beyond number two here if we don't keep rolling. Okay, we talked about changing of priorities. Lie when it's just as easy to tell the truth. So you lie to survive, to protect yourself, because if you tell the truth, you'll get punished too much. You lie in order to get what you want, because if you ask what you really want, they're not going to give it to you, so you got to lie. And what happens is you lie all your life. Lying becomes more natural than truth telling. And so what I do with clients is this. I go, okay, let's say we got 10 people in the room. Do you have, and I picture a filing cabinet where you got a file folder with each person's name on the top. And then in file folder one you put the story you've told them. Folder two, the story you told them. Folder three, the story you've told them. And they start smiling because they've done it. I go, doesn't it take a lot of energy to keep track of all those stories? And wouldn't it be just easier to tell the truth? And they go, it would, but this keeps us safe. So lies are hard to give up. Now, let me give you this. When a person relapses, so you have to understand, relapse is an event, but it's also a process. So the event is the day you pick up. But you could have started the process towards relapse 2 months earlier. Okay? So one of the first, or the thing we say to people is before you go to picking up, you first start with old behavior, addictive behavior. So some will go this. They start to see their pattern. And I refer to them as dominoes that start to fall. So some will start to lie. And then once they lie, they got to have more secrets. Then they got to isolate a bit more. Then they get angry. Then they get lonely. Then they get bored. Then they get full of self-pity. And then they pick up. But it's a pattern. And so every addict has their own pattern that they begin to have to figure out. And they can have a bunch of different patterns depending on the triggers. But lying is often one of those key parts of the pattern that starts them back into the old way. Because once you tell a lie, you got to tell another lie. And then you're too in too deep now to change. So you just keep going with it, and then you relapse. Wearing masks, that was survival. Some people are chameleons. They'll be whatever you want them to be. They'll change colors depending who they are with. And so that is another key thing. To give up a mask is the scariest thing in the world. Now, there's another piece to this. We had a fellow that really was responsible for Finding Freedom started. He was with me at Tamarack, and he said, I want something that helps me grow in my Christian faith. He had been part of Hell's Angels. He was a bodybuilder. He was this massive guy, but he was the most beautiful little soul inside that hard, hard body. And so he came to me one day in tears, and he said this, all my life, my value has come from being the angriest, strongest, toughest man who intimidates everybody. He was an enforcer for Hell's Angels. He says, if I give that up, who am I? I don't have a clue. And I'm afraid to find out. I might be a weakling. I might be nobody. That gave me respect. And so giving up masks can be a very terrifying thing for a lot of people. Isolate, fight, flight. The ultimate of flight is I'm going to hide. That way I'll never get hurt. But some people who are extroverts say, why hide geographically? I'll hide behind walls around my heart. So I'll be the life of the party, but nobody's getting close because I'm hiding. I'm isolating. So there's two different types of isolating. When a person in their pattern towards a relapse starts to isolate, they're in big trouble. because it's pretty hard to stop the train at that point. It's basically they're going to pick up. It's just a matter of when. So isolating is extremely dangerous. Now, you have to be aware of this, and I said this to Mary Charlotte last night. One of my concerns is churches were developed for extroverts, not introverts. Do you want to know what happens when an addict goes into a church who's a very shy, sensitive person? They don't want somebody in their face shaking their hand and say, come meet this person, come meet this person. They want to run out the door if that happens. They want to come in quietly, sit all alone at the back and just spectate. And if we don't allow them to do that, we'll lose them. And so that's not isolating. So a lot of people say you're isolating. No, they're just shy. And they need time with some distance from people in order to feel safe. And we need to be able to respect that. Okay, anxiety issues are huge. So anxiety, one way to look at it is there's constant anxiety that's just below the surface. It can get triggered by 1,000 things. And then once it's triggered, they go to obsession. So we talk about the hamster wheel. So every complex trauma person has a hamster wheel brain. And sometimes it's a pinball, they bounce all over. So you try to have a conversation with them and they're bouncing and you're trying to keep track of what you're talking about. That's what happens in their brain because of anxiety. And so it's hard for them to concentrate, but except when they've got a problem and their anxiety is triggered, then they will stay up all night. And what their brain is trying to do is look at it from every possible angle so I can prepare for every possible situation so I won't get hurt. It's all about staying safe. And every single one of these are safety strategies. So what you begin to realize is that worked when they were a child. It kept them safe. But they now don't work as an adult. They now make life unmanageable and disastrous as an adult. They now backfire. And that is very hard for them to accept. Okay, manipulate. So with this,
what is GAD?
Generalized anxiety disorder.
Oh.
Yeah. So OCD, obsessive compulsive. So basically it's if I do certain things, then I'll prevent something bad from happening. Light switches, counting, washing my hands, etc. Obsessive is I'm obsessed with that problem. I can't let it go. And that's to keep me safe. Okay. Manipulate and control. The key thing with this is it's all about safety, but it's all about getting needs met and not getting hurt. So if in complex trauma, your emotional needs weren't met, some their physical needs weren't met, and some, if they asked or told them what their needs were, they got punished for being selfish. So what they began to realize is nobody cares enough about me to get my needs met. I will have to figure out how to manipulate people to meet my needs. Because I can't go to people and just say, I have a need, please meet it, because I'll get punished for that. And so they have learned to live by manipulating. So they pout, they throw temper tantrums, they give you the silent treatment, they schmooze with you, they guilt trip you, they get angry with you, all working you. And so what you begin to realize is that that's the only way they know how to get their needs met. And for you to just say, hey, tell me your need, I'll be happy to meet it. No, that's never worked before, so why should it work now? So giving up manipulation is very difficult, and it's one of the early dominoes for people, is once they start getting manipulative again, they're in trouble. Okay, control. The only way I get my needs met is if I control everybody, and the only way I don't get hurt is if I'm in control as well. And so control freaks come into play, and that comes out of complex trauma. Now, here's what it's really important to understand, and it's kind of sad. Do you realize that our culture gives raises to control freaks and applauds that? And they are looked up to as being great administrators and great people in society. They get rewarded and validated for that. Try to live with them, and it just is terrible. Okay, now here's where it gets really, really tricky. God's design, so as an infant, parent has total control. Child has zero control, parent has total control. They feed them, change them, take care of every need. determine when they go to bed. Everything is determined by the parent. Total control. God's design is by the time they reach adult life, parents have zero control, child has 100% control. Okay? So if somewhere in that 18, 20 years, there's a gradual shift from the parents having control to the parents giving up control. That's the design. What happens with complex trauma people once they become parents is they go, I'm afraid that when my child hits their teens, they are going to go down the same road I did. So I can't give them too many decisions because they might make a bad one. So let's just kind of break from God's design for a bit, and I'm just going to be a little bit more controlling, and it's all about protecting my kid. That's how they phrase it. Do you want to know what happens with that? Kids say, screw you. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to let you control me. I am trying to create a bit of space for myself so I can grow up. So I'm going to become defiant. I am going to rebel. What then happens to a control freak parent? My child's rebelling, panic, tighten control even more, which causes the child to say rebel even more, and then it just gets wider and wider. Now, where it gets really sad is if that started as a young age. So let's say mom was a control freak from day one, and the child grew up, everything was controlled, what they wore, how they did their hair, everything. And the child starts getting rebellious, okay? Mom keeps amping up the control, trying to get it back. After a while, what the child will do, and this is where a subtle switch takes place in their head. They go, anything that comes out of mom's mouth, I will do the exact opposite. That's oppositional defiance. So mom might say, you've turned into an addict. I know a great treatment center. Please go. They don't go, oh, is that wise? They go, that came out of mom's mouth. I'm doing the exact opposite. So now they rebel against everything out of that authority's mouth and do the exact opposite to their own detriment. And that is very difficult. And that goes even further. All complex trauma people have authority issues. They do not trust authority. They're suspicious of authority. And they have trouble following authority's direction, because they think you're being a control freak by giving them an order. And so that makes the challenge of reparenting addicts, so me as an authority and finding freedom, I'm kind of their surrogate dad. I have to manage their opposition. I can't overreact to that, because that'll drive them further away, but I have to figure out how to manage that so they can grow up. But that is a real challenge when you begin to help. Trust issues we talked about, hypersensitive to criticism and to disrespect. Now, this is very interesting. They criticize themselves constantly, but don't you dare criticize them. They live to be respected, but they don't respect themselves. But if you do the slightest thing that makes them feel disrespected, they explode. So nothing triggers anger more than feeling disrespected. So that is a key thing. So what is very important is they have to experience respect for who they are, not for how they perform. And we fall easily into validating people only when they do good things. We need to validate them for who they are, even if they're not doing anything. So those are all very important. Okay, I see everybody's kind of starting to get bleary-eyed, so we'll do a couple more, and then we'll end it for today. Conflict, they don't do well with that. So conflict was part of life. It was never resolved. Nothing good came out of conflict. So what people do from complex trauma when they face conflict is fight or flight. I will avoid conflict no matter what. I'll be a peacemaker, never rock the boat, make everybody happy, give in, but I will never go into conflict. Or I will fight and I will win every time. So conflict isn't two people on the same team working together. Conflict's you're on the opposite team and I'm on. One of us is going to win, one of us is going to lose. It's never going to be me that loses. So I must win all the time. But conflict is a very difficult issue. Anger. So what is happening? So Ephesians 6, God says, fathers, don't provoke your kids to anger. The word for anger is this stuff from complex trauma. So what comes out when a child's needs aren't met? When they're not loved, when they're disrespected, when they're not accepted, when they're too harshly criticized or punished, they get anger. But what happens if they show that anger? They get punished for showing the anger. So their only option is to stuff it. And so what begins to happen? They get a volcano building. They're stuffing lava. And then they get to adult life, and somebody disrespects them, and the eruption takes place. And it goes from 0 to 100, and there is a swath of damage that is big. But anger is one of the most difficult things for them to deal with, and one of the things that causes them the greatest guilt in their life. But it is huge. And so I have learned as a surrogate dad to addicts is I have to sometimes just absorb some of their anger and not react to it. And once they cool down, help them process it. But anger is a big thing. And then we talked about emotional stuffing that they do. Negative and critical. This is part of that hypervigilance. So I'm looking around me for danger, but I become very negative and critical about everything. And so I walk into a room, I can tell you everything wrong with that church within 5 minutes. I can tell you everything wrong with that person within 5 minutes. I become negative. And so a person from complex trauma, they are in a negative state of mind much more than a positive state of mind. They are critical of everything and everybody, but they can act so encouraging and so positive inside. They're criticizing, and they criticize themselves the most.
Sorry, going back to the anger thing. Some people always keep it suppressed, never show it.
Very good point. If I was to teach an anger seminar, which would take another week, so as it begins to get expressed, it gets expressed. Number one option, explosion. So you throw things, yell, hit things, all of that kind of stuff. But a lot of people go, I never do that, so I must not have any anger issues. And I go, oh, just listen for a little while, okay? So number two becomes, if something's gone wrong, then I must be guilty of something, so I'll beat myself up. So they beat themselves up. Others say, I don't feel any anger. They stuff it so deep that they're not even aware of it. But meanwhile, they got high blood pressure, they can't sleep well, they got health problems beginning. And so that's what we call the somatizing of anger that begins to happen. But the fourth one is probably the most common. And it's what I call underhanded anger. So let's say I'm angry at my wife. So I come home from work and she says, how was your day? I'm angry at her, remember? Fine. You don't seem fine. Something wrong? Nope. Then she's getting angry at me because I'm not talking. And I go, you got an anger problem. You should get that looked at. So what it does is it's sneaky. Okay? Or a culturally acceptable thing is sarcasm. So I tell you what bugs me about you with humor. So you say that, did you mean that? No, I was just joking. But you got the point. I hurt you. And that's that underhanded anger. So it's the silent treatment. It's the little games that we play, banging the cupboards and all of that. But nothing's wrong with me. But it's underhanded anger. So anger will sneak out in most of us. Not necessarily the explosion, but we will find some way of hurting the other person.
But it's the same source.
Same source, yeah. So if you take just the average person in a healthy home, anger is a God-given emotion. It gives us energy, and it tells us something is wrong. So if somebody lies to me, I get angry. Why? Because that's unloving, and anger gives me the energy to bring it back to healthy. We need a honest place here. If a child lies to me, I get angry, but I want them to be honest. So it's to give me the energy to bring it honest. That never happens in complex trauma. You get punished for all kinds of things. You don't have honesty. So the three rules of dysfunction is don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. So you can't talk about anything, can't be honest about anything. You protect secrets. Nobody respects you. It's not safe. It's not fair. But you can't show that anger, so you stuff it down. And so then everybody with complex trauma, they just have tons more anger, and it's just built up anger that they've never seen any resolution to. And that's what makes anger such a big issue with them. So let me just give you this, and I think we'll wrap up. If you, if a church was to give an anger seminar to people from complex trauma, it would probably do more damage than good. Because what you would say was, the Bible says, in your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Ephesians 4. So you never go to bed angry and all of that. And what you're really doing is teaching them to stuff it. And then what you say is, the Bible says, rejoice always. Rejoice in the Lord. You should be happy all the time. Anger is sin. Well, you've just destroyed it for them. And then you say, you just need to pray and ask God to take your anger away and help you. That won't work. And so what will happen to them is they'll come, they'll try what you're offering, but you haven't got to the complex trauma and the years of stuffing it. And that was all healthy anger because life wasn't loving for them. They should be angry as a child, but it wasn't resolved. They were made to feel bad for that, and they stuffed it. And now, if you don't help them resolve that and understand it, and you make them feel bad for having anger, you're no different than their parents, and you do a lot of damage. So most anger management, they're great for kind of people from more healthy homes. They are disastrous for people from complex trauma. They don't go deep enough, and they give them teaching that ends up not working, and then they're disillusioned, and they blame themselves. Okay, that's our day. Wonderful. We'll see where we end up tomorrow.
Do numb?
Numb. Oh, okay. Numb and avoid. So some want to feel positive emotions and not negative, but they're not good at stuffing. So what I tell clients is this. The worst torture to give an addict is to stick him in a room all by himself with nothing to do. Because then they just have to sit and be with themselves. And so they're not comfortable in their own skin because of shame. So an addict has to constantly be busy. They need a constant distraction. Video games, TV, whatever. Because they can't stand the thought of being alone in themselves. And so that's part of that numb. So take it further. And this goes into a very different direction, but a very important one. Numbing, one way it happens is through cutting, self-harm. And many don't realize that, but it's a numbing thing. So what's happening is a couple things. Number one, I'd rather feel physical pain than emotional. So I'll cut to feel physical, and that'll block the motions. Okay, so that's there. And then when I cut myself and feel physical pain, it actually acts as a release for emotional pain, I think. So it actually feels therapeutic. And so that becomes cutting. But cutting releases endorphins in the brain and all of that. And so that's part of the chemical thing that is there. But food addictions come out of complex trauma. Cutting comes out of complex trauma. They're all things that are trying to numb feeling painful emotions. Let me give you one other thing on the anger. Anger releases cortisol like nothing else, other than trauma. So what I want you to understand is this. Complex trauma people usually become addicted to cortisol. They need it to feel normal. So they become addicted to anger. So when they feel anger, it gives them energy. They don't feel any other emotions when they're angry. It medicates all those other emotions, so they want to feel angry. And so it then allows them to be in control and to manipulate people because they're so intimidating. Everybody says, okay, whatever you want, just don't get mad. So anger takes on all of these different roles in their life, and they become addicted to anger. And so now if they aren't angry, they don't feel good. They just feel blah, life is boring. And so they go out and create some anger. And so anger becomes an addiction in many ways for a lot of people. So tomorrow at 11, I want to take the first four chapters of the Bible and look at the needs God built into us. And so what basically it is that God made us with physical needs, but he also made us with emotional needs, relational needs, and spiritual needs. And so if we don't meet those needs consistently, what happens to us? And the rest of the Bible kind of shows that. So I want to develop it from Genesis 1 to 4. And so what it does is it sets up a person for addiction, to feel a deep emptiness and discontent.
And in the afternoon?
The afternoon, we'll quickly go through the rest of these if I can do anything quickly. But I want to go into, okay, as a church, how can we do a better job of reaching and helping these people?
Changing ourselves,
changing our tactics, all of those things. I'll end with number 20 just so I don't have to start there. Escape from fantasy. Children where life is mainly pain. So if you look at if this is a line here of normal, and you look at the emotional life of a kid in a healthy home, most of their emotions are in the positive side, and they get the odd dip into the negative emotions, okay? But mainly positive. As you look at complex trauma, their emotional world is here. It doesn't ever get into the positive outside of fleeting pleasure, which doesn't satisfy. So their emotional world is here. So how do you survive when you're in constant pain? You block it, numb it, have distractions, but then you escape into a fantasy world where everything's positive. And so they become great at coping in fantasy. And so when they meet a new person and they get that oxytocin, where does their brain go? To a fantasy creation of a relationship. Doesn't match a reality, but they have lived in fantasy. And so fantasy is a huge escape tactic to try and feel a positive life.